The plane was too high to have been shot down by a surface-to-air missile, as claimed by Daesh. The initial investigation points to either a mechanical failure or a bomb placed on board the plane prior to takeoff.
After enduring months of bombing by U.S.-backed fighter jets from Saudi Arabia, the people of Yemen are bracing themselves for another kind of attack. Cyclone Chapala is the second strongest storm ever recorded in the Arabian Sea. It's set to make landfall tonight in Yemen, where coastal cities could receive up to 8 years' worth of rain in a single night. Yemen, like most parts of the Arabian Peninsula, has an extremely arid climate and gets very little rainfall, but tonight the country's being hit with its first ever cyclone. A cyclone's a tropical storm known in the eastern U.S. as a hurricane. In the Northwest Pacific Ocean, these storms are called typhoons. But all three terms refer to the same kind of weather event. A rotating storm resulting from warm tropical oceans and cooler, moist clouds above. These conditions can create some of the most violent storms on the planet. A similar unprecedented storm hit Mexico's west coast in October as meteorologists warn that human-induced changes to the climate will lead to more frequent and more violent storms than any previously recorded.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Don Zur, Callie Mikhail, and Ken Jones. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Special thanks to Robin Ryan. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Callie Mikhail.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, the topic is the Portland City Council's public hearing on fossil fuel policy and oil train resolution. At 9, on Alternative Radio, Palestinian-American journalist Ali Abunima speaks on justice in Palestine. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, chats, and commentary. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Stage and Studio, Dee Mae Roberts features two shows adapted from classical works. She talks with Kate Belden of Polymath Art Theater about their adaptation of Macbeth, A Dark Retelling, and Jeffrey Puka of Play on Words about Women of Troy. And at 11:30, an Art Focused, host Andre Middleton speaks with Ben Shockey and Rebecca Welty of the Sitka Center and Greg Wilbur, metal worker and Sitka instructor, about the 22nd Annual Sitka Art Invitational. Thank you for listening to KBOO, and thanks KBOO members for your generous support. If you want to become a member, you just have to go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. Stay tuned now for an interview with author Mira Suramanian, who'll be speaking this evening at Powell's on Hawthorne about her new book, A River Runs Again, India's Natural World in Crisis. Good night, Callie.
Good night, Ken. Good night, Danielle.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We are very lucky today to be joined in the studio by Meera Subramanian. She is the author of A River Runs Again. And we'll be speaking tonight at Powell's Books on Hawthorne, right?
Correct.
Meera, can you tell us a little bit about this book? You talked to a number of farmers, people who are directly affected by the situation. Could you just tell us a little bit?
Sure. India is a place where population is just colliding with natural resource limitations. And so looking at issues of sustainability, it seemed like this was the place to really go to see how India was facing it and how the people there are dealing with environmental crises on multiple levels. And I use the framework of the five elements as a way to dive into just five stories about earth, water, fire, air, and ether, which was population. And so I went and explored over the past 3 years, really pretty intensively, spent a lot of time in India meeting people on the ground and learning how they were facing some of these issues.
And could you talk about, like, what was a really poignant story of somebody, a farmer that you have in your book?
Yeah, I met a lot of amazing people. I spent time down in Karnataka with some farmers there, but a lot of the time I was up in Punjab, which is up in the north part of the country, right near Pakistan. And farmers there, that area is like basically the breadbasket of India. So this is the place where wheat and rice and cotton are being grown really intensively. And so it was a real focus of the Green Revolution in the 60s that brought in Western technologies and hybrid seeds and high levels of pesticide and fertilizer use. And they dug wells all over the landscape just to supply lots of water to these crops. And they did really well, but now, 40 years later, they're looking at just serious environmental degradation of the water and of the soil. Cancer rates there are higher than they are anywhere else in India. And I went looking for the organic farmers because there's a movement there by a nonprofit called Kheti Virasat Mission is helping train farmers and how to use sustainable methods. And these are methods really that were, you know, in place before the Green Revolution hit. It's how farmers have been farming for centuries. And so I went and met all these amazing farmers, and some of them were just really just, you know, one of them said, I farmed with chemicals because I didn't know you couldn't do it any other way. And then he learns these methods, and I went out with his farm and just sat with him as he, you know, dug up the soil and held it out and just said, smell this. Like, this soil is alive in a way that the chemically treated soil is just not. It's just not. And he was just seeing his soil basically come back to life. And it takes time. It's a transition to do that. But they were just recreating a bond with the land while also, like, having it turn back into productivity after really kind of dying in so many ways.
And you talked about the Green Revolution. That's something that activist Vandana Shiva, particular in the Punjab, has talked a lot about, and talked about GMO crops and the problems that they've presented. Is that something that that you came across in your conversations with farmers?
I did, especially GM cotton has totally dominated the market. As soon as that was made legal in India, it just swept over the landscape. And so I think it's about 90% of the cotton that they're growing in India is genetically modified. But at the same time, Indians have been really, really resistant about food crops. And so I haven't checked really recently, but they were still like just talking about maybe accepting eggplant, GM-modified eggplant, and they had not approved it. And there's been a lot of resistance on that level for food crops.
And as far as farmers organizing in resistance, is that something that you came across?
I did in some way. It was more a loose affiliation. I definitely heard about on-the-ground activism, like I've heard about that around GM crops. But what I was experiencing was more just farmers individually working there. It's a land of small farmers, so we're looking at like acreage of 3 to 5 acres or something is like that would be like a 5-acre farm would be pretty big for a lot of the farmers there. So a lot of them are just, you know, and they're subsistence farmers. They're not making a lot of money. They're saving, they're growing food for their own families, and they're sending the rest to market. And so there wasn't on the streets type activism. I wasn't seeing that as much. It was more this support system that was based around the nonprofit that was helping train them and basically just spreading the word about how this works and also proving as an example to their fellow farmers. Because I definitely met farmers who said, I'm going to wait and see how my neighbor, like see how their crops do before I transition over. But that was happening. And of course, interestingly, that when they transitioned part of their land to organic, they were definitely keeping that for their family and sending the rest to market.
Wow. And you talk about also the growth in the price of land itself and for people going into farming and how difficult that is. Another thing that Vandana Shiva talks about is the high rate of suicide among farmers. How many people are being pushed off of their land and unable to get it back?
Yeah, that is the land prices are just outrageous how much it's gone up. So many areas, especially around cities the cities are just expanding exponentially. And so those farmlands become prime development areas. And farmers get the money. They might not have any other skills in terms of what they do with their money. I was hearing about, farmers going out and buying gold faucets for their new homes, but they've never had running water before. I mean, I was hearing stories like that. Dealing with just an indebted system because the Green Revolution, again, offers a package of products that work really well when they work together, but they all cost money. The seeds cost money, the fertilizers cost money, and the pesticides. And it's all still highly subsidized. What's interesting is that those subsidies are going away, which both makes it more economically accurate in terms of what these things actually cost the farmers, but then that's just putting the farmers that are already really don't have many economic resources, putting them in even a tougher position, and the suicides are bad there. I mean, pesticides are used to commit suicide, in a frightening level.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah.
And so your book is titled A River Runs Again, and you have a story in the book about villagers bringing back to life a dead river. Could you talk a little about that?
Yeah, that was amazing. This was in Rajasthan, which is a few hours south of Delhi. And it's a really semi-arid landscape. It's always been very dry and always very dependent on the monsoon rains, which just come seasonally. And basically the wells had all dried up, a river that was never, it was always a seasonal river, but basically the underground water was gone a couple generations ago. And then about 25 years ago, an elder told this young Gandhian revolutionary had gone out there. He's like, I'm going to start a hospital or something. And an old man from the village is like, we need water. Like, that's what we need. What you need to do? And this man is now known as the Rain Man of Rajasthan. He told the young Rain Man of Rajasthan, Rajendra Singh, he said, go build a little dam right there. That's where the water comes. Make the water stop so it doesn't just run away, and the rivers will come back. And everybody thought he was crazy, but he was a young activist. He was ready to do hard work, and he just spent, he says, 3 years building this dam in place with just a shovel. And everyone thought he was mad, and then in a year or two, the wells suddenly just came back to life, and it worked. And so they've done that all across the landscape, just small-scale dams to help recharge the system. And again, I think, when I was working on this book, I just kept thinking, like, this is not India. This is everywhere. Like, what if these kinds of strategies were being put in place in Texas, in California, and all these places that are dealing with erratic rain patterns and a drying, warming world?
Mm. And what do you think are some of the lessons for us here in the Pacific Northwest and in the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is such an agricultural region that, again, just thinking about how to farm for the long term in a sustainable way is really key. I combined with on top of just going out and talking to people and seeing stories on the ground, which I did extensively, I balanced that out in the book with just real hard science and talking to scientists and pursuing research to find out, like, what their farmers are experiencing. How does that, how does that play out? Like, would India starve if they went organic? It's a really, really very real question. It's not just how much can we push towards sustainability without risking starvation? And so there were places that were finding, I was looking at places in Michigan that had been doing long-term research on organic, and they're finding the threshold of where you can reduce the chemical inputs and implement sustainable strategies like intercropping and using nitrogen-fixing plants and no-till methods and get the same crop yields as when you're just dousing them with chemicals. So places like in the Northwest where strategies for farming really need to make the soil stay alive for the long run, I think those strategies could really work. And then you also, when you have live soil, you have a carbon storage place. So as we think about climate change, this keeping that soil alive becomes important on many levels.
Mm. Right, of course, because if you're continuing to dump chemicals, that kills off that soil or depletes it.
Exactly.
large extent. And so you're speaking tonight at Powell's. Are you on a tour across the country?
Yeah, I'm on a tour. It's been really great. I've been in New York and D.C. and Atlanta and Austin and back. I used to live in Cottage Grove, Oregon for a long time, working at Aprovecha Research Center, which was a place focused on sustainability. So I was it's really been great. I was down in Cottage Grove last night, and it's great to come back here. And a lot of the stories that I was working on in India were really just grew out of my time here in Oregon. So it's really wonderful to be back. And then I'll be heading to India in January to talk about it there.
Wow. And what's been the reception? Has this led to any connections of people trying to organize on some of these issues?
Yeah, I mean, I've been getting a really great response as I've been talking with people on like all these different levels. I've met young Asian students that are here and they're working on nonprofits. I had somebody talking about that they have been working with renewable microgrid systems. He's actually like has his own business. He was asking about advice about how to get those systems to India, which is corrupt. Is a big problem sometimes to make those partnerships happen. But so it's been wonderful. I've been meeting people from really like across the spectrum of what their interests in how they are engaged with these topics. But it's been a great response.
Wow. And again, it's Meera Subramanian. She's author of a new book, A River Runs Again, about the situation in India with the salination of so much of the soil and the rivers becoming depleted from the Green Revolution. Mm-hmm. And you can hear her talk and ask her questions and I think get a copy of the book at Powell's on Hawthorne, which is 37th and Hawthorne, this evening at 7:30 p.m. And that is Monday, November 2nd here in Portland. Meera, thank you so much for joining us on KBOO.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Jinka Soderberg with KBOO News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Imperialism, Climate Crisis, and Struggle, an evening with Harsha Walia and Luz Rivera on Sunday, November 8th at 5 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland.